Welcome to the tax update for the month ending 31st January 2014. This is part of a monthly series which we hope will enable you to keep up to date by spending 5 minutes listening to the podcast and, if anything's of interest, looking at the detailed notes which accompany the podcast and, if further research is required, the links within those notes. I certainly hope that the hiatus period of meeting the self-assessment filing deadline has passed and that you're now able to sit back and relax and do some professional development. So I begin with HMRC publishing details of its review and appeal process, which is a 6-page report of the internal review and tribunal appeal process. Definitely worth a read, if only for the statistics and the rather depressing news that taxpayers only won 17% of the decisions at the first year tribunal. HMRC have also published draft legislation for the NIC rates, limits and thresholds for the next fiscal year, 2014-15, and there's a link to the draft legislation as well as explanatory memorandum. But do remember, this is subject to parliamentary review and approval. HMRC have also published a consultative document on tackling marketed avoidance schemes, and in essence what they're going to demand is that the tax which has been sheltered by an avoidance scheme is payable until such time as the courts can resolve the issue. So at 57 pages, this is a necessary read for anyone involved in this particular area of advice. HMRC have also published a new format, changing extra-statutory concession D33, which for compensation payments of more than $500,000 will now require a claim to be made. Very interesting, HMRC have published their view of the tax implications of the transition adopting FRS 101 and 102, and they've produced two papers of how the transition from the current UK GAAP to, say, FRS 101 or FRS 102 would affect tax computations, and this will be of interest to those advising large companies, but it might well be of interest to some of the larger income tax cases of partnerships. There's a very interesting pair of decisions on the penalties being imposed by HMRC, and in the first case, Marion Armitage was a school teacher who had been in pay as you earn for 35 years, but then newly started a new source of income and was required to make a self-assessment return, but she'd never done this before, so she phoned up HMRC seeking advice, but she was already late in notifying chargeability. And when she phoned, HMRC advised her to wait until a notice to file was received and then complete this, which she did, and paid the tax. But of course, by the time she paid the tax, she was too late, and so HMRC imposed a 5% penalty of £120, because technically she had been late in paying her tax. But she thought that she had a reasonable excuse, because HMRC had not told her that part of the story, and had not advised her to make a payment to account if she wished to avoid paying the tax. So it's quite an interesting decision, and the tribunal judge, I think, came to a very fair decision. Having listened to the arguments on both sides, he pointed out that HMRC tried to be helpful, but the advice they gave was incomplete. And if she had been correctly advised about the need to make a payment to account, he thought that the lady would have done so, and consequently she had a reasonable excuse, and the penalty was reduced to nil. And that's an interesting contrast to the Beavers decision, which is quite interesting, because Mr. Beaver was frustrated in filing his tax return, partly because the HMRC system had failed and his UTR number no longer worked, but then, having been given a new number and an extended deadline by HMRC, he thought he had submitted his file tax return electronically, but in fact he didn't press the submit button, so he hadn't technically sent in his return. And the tribunal had to look at this and say, is it easy to check whether the return has been lodged? And they thought it is. So therefore, he did not have a reasonable excuse, and he was liable to a penalty under Schedule 55 of Finance Act 2009. And there was no reason to it reduced that penalty because there weren't special circumstances. So Mr. Martin had to pay his penalty. But I think the final decision to talk about today is a cracker because it concerns Dr. Simidian, who was in dispute with HMRC and ultimately the First Tier Tribunal's decision about travel expenses in the computation of his profits from his private practice as a medical consultant. I've given a good summary of the case, but in essence, the issue where Dr. Simidian and HMRC and the First Tier Tribunal disagreed was in relation to the travel expenses he incurred in travelling between NHS hospitals and the private hospitals, and travelling between home and the private hospitals, and travel between hospitals and a patient's home for a home visit. And there was a careful analysis of all the relevant cases, including Horton versus Young, the builder, whose base of business was his home, Newsom versus Robertson, the barrister, and Sargent versus Barnes, the dentist, as well as a few other interesting cases. But the key point really was that when he was travelling in the disputed areas, there was a duality of purpose, and that duality of purpose was fatal to any claim because it failed the test in the legislation of being wholly and exclusively. So despite the fact that Dr. Simidian did a lot of private work at home and had an office as well as a medical library and filing cabinet, he was not entitled to deduct the disputed expenses, and the upper tier tribunal, which creates a decision of precedent, supported the decision of the first tier tribunal that even though his home was a place of business, it was not his base of business, and therefore the disputed travel expenses were not allowable for tax purposes. And if you've got clients who are doctors with a mixture of private and National Health Service employment work, I'd recommend this decision as a must read. Thanks very much for listening.